This episode of The Curbsiders is brought to you in partnership with the Society of Hospital Medicine. Members can claim CME and mock credit at www.shmlearningportal.org/curbsiders to claim CME and mock credit.
Podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're right.
Hey guys, we're back.
Hi, how you doing?
Oh, that was horrifying.
I know.
I'm doing okay. This is one of my favorite shows that we do because I like to think that there's a lot of low value practices out there, things we do for no reason, if you will. And it's always nice to use the show to shed light on some of those things and hopefully get people to change their practice. Paul, can you tell people more or less what we do on this show?
Happy to. We are the Internal Medicine Podcast, and we use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge, plus or minus some shaming about not listening to the first 10 minutes, which I think I'll probably forego for tonight, just because I'm in a good mood after this episode.
With us tonight, we do have the great Dr. Justin Lee Burke, though he's muted for most of the episode due to some mic difficulties. But Justin, I kind of like the AirPods that you have because it's kind of like it reminds me of Howard Stern when he would cut to his producer in the booth.
I'm glad I can remind you of Howard Stern.
It was a very successful, or is a very successful radio show. You know, this is kind of a radio show we do here. All right, so on the show tonight, Justin, we talked about a couple topics. Did you want to remind the audience what those were?
Absolutely. We had three big topics today. We talked about doing echocardiography or doing an echo for syncope workup in unselected patients. We talked about the uselessness of DocuSafe as a medication for constipation on the inpatient wards. And then finally talked about sliding scale insulin as monotherapy and how it doesn't really do a good job except chase sugars. So the three of those are kind of the big core topics for today of going over through the things we do for no reason.
And I should remind the audience that this episode is co-produced with the Society for Hospital Medicine and the Journal of Hospital Medicine, and will be available for CME and mock credit on their website. And we would like to thank them very much for bringing us this great content. We have two wonderful speakers. Paul, you're going to tell us about the first speaker now.
Sure, happy to. I'm going to tell you about Dr. Tony Brew. Dr. Tony Brew is an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a hospitalist and director of internal medicine resident education at the VA Boston Healthcare System. His research includes no-value care, also known as things we do for no reason. He is also core faculty at the Harvard Center for Bioethics, where he is a course director and co-course director of a number of classes. He's also, he didn't send this along with his bio, but also notorious, or I should say famous, for his spectacular tweetorials. He's probably one of the best followers on Twitter if you're interested in medical education. And he's at Tony_Brew for the interested.
Also, he's a returning guest. He was on a prior Hotcakes episode, I think sometime back in maybe November 2018, something like that.
Sure. Peabody Award winning.
Our second guest is also a returning guest, Dr. Lenny Feldman. He is the founder and program director of the Johns Hopkins Combined Internal Medicine Pediatrics Urban Health Residency and the Osler Internal Medicine Urban Health Primary Care Track. He graduated from Brown University, received a medical degree from the University of Maryland School of Medicine. He completed his internship and residency in internal medicine and pediatrics at the University of North Carolina. He's the editor-in-chief for the Society of Hospital Medicine, Consultative and Perioperative Medicine Essentials for Hospitalists, and a deputy editor for the Journal of Hospital Medicine, where he's the editor of the series Choosing Wisely, Things We Do for No Reason. His research is focused on resident and provider decision-making, and he is a leader in medical education, program development, and high-value care. It's an absolute joy to talk to both of these returning guests, so I can't wait for you all to hear it.
Did you guys hear about the guy who took DocuSate? He couldn't give a crap.
Are we
I have a feeling that's a Stewart original. I feel pretty strongly. That's one he just came up with on the fly.
Just came right on out.
Lenny and Tony, we're gonna start with our stock question. Can you give one-liners to describe yourselves? And we'll start with Lenny.
Sure. So I'm a 46-year-old med-peds doc and now a new father who used to have hobbies and now I don't.
You is dead and the new you has no hobbies.
Yeah, what hobbies have you sacrificed?
Yeah, there's been a lot of things that have died in the last 8 months. So when I was last on Curbsiders, I was talking about my love for the Defenders and all those Marvel shows on Netflix. And now they're all gone.
Yeah.
They've all been canceled.
It's going to be replaced with like Mickey Mouse and Dora the Explorer and whatever else is hip these days.
Yeah. And it's perfect because I can't watch them anymore anyway.
Tony, what about you? What's ruining your life these days?
I do have two young children, but I wouldn't say they're killing my habits or hobbies because I don't know that I had any before I had children other than medicine. But I'm a 41-year-old New York transplant to New England and husband to an endocrinologist. And as I mentioned, I have two young children. And what I really do now in my spare time is watch Stranger Things. I don't know if you guys are currently watching that, but as someone who was born in 1978, it's like really allowing me to relive the 1980s in a way that's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. So did you have a level 20 paladin? Was that yours?
Is that a reference to Dungeons and Dragons?
D&D.
Yeah. So that I never got into. I do feel for Mike, though, the character Mike.
Yes.
All right. So that was that your pick of the week? Because that's kind of where we're going next. All right.
Yeah.
But Stranger Things was your pick of the week? Really?
No. Lenny, you said you had nothing that you could do because you had a child.
Except Stranger Things.
Yeah, that's the only Netflix show left.
He's been sneaking in between diaper changes and bottles. He's been sneaking Stranger Things.
Absolutely.
Well, I watch it with my four-year-old, and we just cover her eyes whenever is necessary.
So the whole show?
She refuses to go to bed.
You're really selling the parenting thing to the whole audience that doesn't have kids right now.
Well, Paul's not even on the call.
Oh, go ahead, Lenny. Lenny, sorry, I'm being rude. What is your pick of the week before
to
Stuart?
I was just going to point out that it's clear that Tony is also not a pediatrician, just an internist.
Yeah. Why? Because he's letting his kids stay up?
And watch Stranger Things at the age of four. Yes, that would be the correct answer.
So pick of the week is parenting.
Baby 411 book, something like that. So my pick of the week, I have gotten into listening to the Malcolm Gladwell Revisionist History podcast. The new season is out, and he's done a couple on the LSAT, where he took the LSAT along with his assistant, and you get to find out if he was able to beat his assistant on the LSAT and what the LSAT actually tests. And then it makes me start thinking about all the tests that we have to take,
like
the board
MCAT
tests and the USMLEs and all those sorts of things and what those are actually testing. And just an interesting thing to think about as a medical educator.
Yeah. As a challenge, you should go back to USMLE step one, see if you can pass it.
There's no way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really not. The questions are just so esoteric.
Well, and I certainly would have failed the MCATs if I tried to take them right now.
Stuart, what's your pick of the week?
Oh, yeah. So my pick of the week is actually somewhat of a shout out to Dr. Gray, who runs a series, a medical student series, and he has a website called the Medical School Headquarters. He just started a new website called Find Shadowing. It's specifically a website to help connect students and physicians for shadowing opportunities. He's specifically looking for staff physicians to sign up who are interested and to have medical students shadow them, specifically in like private practice settings that they wouldn't otherwise have exposure to.
Can you say again what it was called?
It's called findshadowing.com.
My pick of the week is going to be a podcast. I've recommended the podcast before, but I'm recommending a specific episode. This is the Knowledge Project podcast by Shane Parrish. And he had on a social psychologist named Jonathan Haidt, who he works at, I believe it's NYU, and he's written some books. And the discussion was talking about parenting, the use of social media in kids and teenagers, and the epidemic of anxiety and depression, suicide cutting behaviors that's going on. He talked about like coddling kids versus free range parenting. To me, at this point in life, it was just very interesting. And he also talked a lot about the kind of the behaviors of social media and how people get attacked on social media for this like call out culture. I found it really interesting. I think a lot of people, if you hang out on Med Twitter or if you have kids, you would definitely find this interesting, very enlightening. And this guy is an absolute expert, knows all the literature, and was kind of teasing what will be coming out in the future, like what we'll know. So I highly recommend that.
Yeah, one of my favorite books I read in the last 10 years is Jonathan Haidt's The Righteous Mind. And I think one of your prior guests recommended it as a pick of the week. It's an absolutely phenomenal book.
Can I just ask, what age will everybody let their child have a smartphone?
Oh, man. Jeez.
Between the two of you, Matt and Stuart, how many kids do you have?
I've got 5. He's got 4.
Yeah. So what Jonathan Haidt was recommending was that he said basically, don't let them on social media. Didn't really comment on the smartphone. I mean, like, if I think I'd be okay if my kids like playing Minecraft and things like that, but I think keeping them off social media, he was recommending age 16, which I imagine is would take heroic effort to do.
Yes, yes.
But he said that that's where a lot of like they're just not mature enough, their brain's not developed enough, and it just mm-hmm. he thinks it's like just tremendously dangerous to have young kids, especially young women, on social media at that age.
If I could keep them away from smartphones till they're 25, that would be best, honestly. Because it does, even when they're 16, I've seen too much.
Let's see if we could bring in Paul Williams and see if his audio is working now.
Hi, guys. Am I here? Do you hear me?
You are here. Hello, Paul.
Fantastic. Glad to be back. Thanks so much for having me.
Paul, this is, you know...
You missed a great episode.
It's like my son being at the end of the movie. What did I miss?
It couldn't be a better timing, Paul, because we'd love a pick of the week from you before we get into some things we do for no reason.
Thanks
Picks
for waiting for me.
Isn't that my most no reason?
Useful contribution is probably my pick of the week. I'm gonna go with, as per usual, something that was for like the 1% of our audience. I'm gonna pick a movie called The Wrong Guy. It's a 1997 comedy starring Dave Foley. It is absolutely unavailable on any streaming platform, so if you want to see it, you have to buy it. Dave Foley, you may recall from news radio, he was in the Kids in the Hall for our older listeners, and is one of the funniest human beings on the planet. And he considers this actually his greatest project, and it is one of the best comedies I think I've seen in the past 10 years. It's absurd. There's physical comedy. Dave Foley gives a manic performance that I've never seen anything like it. It is spectacular. And basically, it's about a guy who gets passed over promotion and in the boardroom is witnessed by many people threatening to murder his boss. And then he goes to confront his boss and finds him murdered. And he becomes convinced that he is, of course, accused of the crime. And it doesn't hurt that he leaves the office screaming and holding a bloody knife, and then sort of hilarity ensues from there. So it's a great movie if you're a comedy nerd and have some money to blow to actually buy the thing, because that's the only way you're going to see it. So that would be The Wrong Guy, starring Dave Foley.
And apparently it's, I did find it streaming somewhere. Huh, interesting.
Probably not legally.
How many Rotten Tomatoes?
Oh, because it's not even, I don't think, released in the States. I'm not sure he actually generated enough critical reviews to actually get the Rotten Tomatoes.
If it wasn't released in the States, there's actually, it wouldn't be illegal for it to be on some platforms.
Okay, so let's get away from the legal...
84%.
It's the legal good. Repercussions of illegally streaming video. Lenny, can you tell us, we're going to talk about things we do for no reason. Can you remind the audience what that is and why it exists, what we're doing here?
Sure. I wanted to start off, though, with a thing we do for no reason, which was the last time I was on the show, you guys beeped me about 100 times. I think I am the most beeped person in Curbsider history.
Oh, man, I'll have to go back and listen to the episode.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I was beeped a ton.
Even more than Beast?
Did we get you in trouble?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of the residents thought I was cussing all over the place.
Well, it was a kind of a cuss word. He was mentioning a very specific EHR,
No. Well, it was more that you were beeping a famous university.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
Cashlack. Yes.
Yeah. So let's just say Cashlack tonight instead of mentioning said university.
I think I got it. I think you drove home the point.
I'm so sorry, Lenny. This is the first I'm hearing of that.
Yeah, this is the first you're hearing of those.
You're the responsible party.
I'm 100% responsible. I feel bad. I'm really sorry.
He's got some street cred now, though.
I needed to get it off my chest.
Okay, so on to things we do for no reason.
Yes, so real things that we do for no reason. So this started in 2012. I started giving talks at the Society of Hospital Medicine annual meeting, and it turned into an annual talk, covered about 3 to 4 topics each time I did the talk. And then in about 2015, I was able to convince Andy Auerbach, who was the editor at that time of the Journal of Hospital Medicine, that we should start this as a series in the Journal of Hospital Medicine. And so we had an editorial talking about the series in October of 2015, and then have been producing these Things We Do for No Reason articles ever since. And the basic idea is these are, in terms of high-value care, this is still the low-hanging fruit of high-value care. These are issues or topics or diagnostic studies or medications, whatever you want, that have no evidence behind them, don't help our patients whatsoever, and are things that we should really just get rid of for the most part. So this is not trying to compare this thing, it works well, and this thing may work about as well, and which one costs more, and that we're not getting into the minutiae there, those gray zones. This is stuff that just doesn't help anybody, that has been handed down from generation to generation, and we just keep doing it. And I think the most important part that hopefully people get out of this is not the specific things we talk about, although they're interesting, but what hopefully people get out of this is that they become a little skeptical about what they're learning, and they question what they're learning, and they begin to say, you know, maybe some of what I'm being told, I'm just being told it because that's what my teacher was told, that's what my attending was told, and so they're just passing it down without having really thought about it. So hopefully we get people to think.
We call that ABM, attending-based medicine.
Stuart, would you like to read our first case?
Sure. Which one's Echo. Our first case? Oh, Echo. A 57-year-old female presented to the emergency department after a syncopal episode. She had just eaten a wonderful dinner when she slumped over and became unresponsive. She regained consciousness 30 seconds later and quickly returned to baseline mental status. She denied any chest pain, shortness of breath, or palpitations. Her medical history included hypertension and hypothyroidism. Her medication regimen was unchanged. Vital signs, including orthostatic blood pressures, were within normal ranges. Physical exam, chest x-ray, CBC, chemistry, BNP, and troponin were all within normal ranges. That's it.
You've been on the show before. Did you want to ask a follow-up question or prompt our guest?
So before we move on, and I'm going to have to excuse myself for 1 second because my daughter is at the door and has no key to the house, could we please define syncope?
I'd love to. So the 2017 ACC-AHA guideline has actually a really nice definition. And so I'll kind of read it semi-verbatim. So they say it's a symptom, and I actually kind of like the fact that they include the fact that it's a symptom. So it's a symptom that presents with an abrupt, transient, complete loss of consciousness associated with an inability to maintain postural tone with rapid and spontaneous recovery. And what's interesting is they don't include in the definition that it's from cerebral hypoperfusion, though they do comment that that's the presumed mechanism. So it's a slightly different definition than the one that I have typically taught, in that it includes the fact that it's actually a symptom, not in and of itself really a diagnosis. and that the presumed mechanism is cerebral hypoperfusion. That's from the 2017 ACC AHA guidelines.
Tony, so you've defined syncope. Now, what is the rationale? Like, echoes, working in the hospital, it seems like everybody that has syncope gets an echo. And we wouldn't be talking about it if that were the right thing to do. So, but why do people think that's the right thing to do?
So before I answer that question, I just want to be clear. When we're talking about, you know, a thing we do for no reason, what we're talking about here is echo for unselected patients with syncope, right? So there's clearly going to be patients in whom an echo makes a lot of sense. And just as you said, Matt, I think what happens, unfortunately, and I see this when I pick up patients in the morning admitted by a night float resident, you know, a 57-year-old like this patient, you know, automatically as part of the plan is echo without really thought to what am I looking for.
Right.
So there's really two flavors of things that we're looking for with an echo. One is structural heart disease, and I'll give examples of that in a moment. And the other is risk factors for other causes of syncope. In particular there, it's reduced EF, because patients with reduced EF are at risk for VT-VF. And I don't think there are many house staff or many attendings even who are necessarily saying, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get an echo to look for the reduced EF because that might be predisposing to VT-VF. I think most are looking for structural heart disease. Things like severe aortic stenosis, HOCM, obviously very rarely an atrial myxoma, and then a few other things, pericardial effusion, severe enough to cause tamponade. There are some cases of pulmonary arterial hypertension that can cause syncope, and then you might even see some clues to a pulmonary embolism. But frankly, on that list, I think most of the time we're looking for aortic stenosis. Mm-hmm. At least in my experience, that's what I'm looking for.
So how often are we ordering these right now, though?
So as you might imagine, it really depends on the study you look at. It depends on the population that's included in the cohorts. It's probably, I'll speak from my experience, it seems like about half. And that's not unpublished, that's just firsthand experience. The studies that were quoted in the article that we're talking about tonight had ranges anywhere between 30 and 90%. So, you know, huge variety. And again, that kind of gets to the idea that it depends on the cohort you're looking at. What's interesting is a more recent study from 2018 that kind of looked at all admissions with a diagnosis of syncope, and they used the nationwide inpatient sample database. So it's a huge database. And the rates are actually far lower. It's on the order of 5 to 7% of patients with an admitting diagnosis of syncope had an echo. But what's curious is I would have expected that number to go down from 2001 to 2014. It's actually gone up from 5% to 6.8%, which, again, I kind of felt like people were beginning to clue into the fact that we don't need to do echoes in everybody, but this suggests that that's actually not the case.
Why do you think that it is?
Part of me wonders if the electronic medical record has made it a little bit easier to order an echo, and the availability of echoes in the hospital setting has probably increased from 2001 to 2014. I bet you now you can get one more easily than you could 15, 20 years ago.
Well, it seems to me, you know, in terms of, you hate to admit this, but there are certain diagnoses or admitting reasons that you see and you just kind of go, oh God, here we go. And I feel like syncope is one of those things. So I feel like the echo represents almost kind of a quiet desperation, because it feels like so often you do the million-dollar workup and just kind of nothing really comes back localizing. Do you have a sense of how often the echo is sort of actually, not even the echo, how often do you actually find sort of a definitive diagnosis for syncope after someone's admitted for it?
Yeah, so again, depends on the cohort, depends on the study, but somewhere on the order of up to maybe 40, even 60% of patients in some cohorts can have no diagnosis found, right? So it depends on how confidently you need to be of the diagnosis in the cohort you're looking at. In terms of how often an echo finds you a diagnosis, it actually is probably helpful to take a step back and say, how often are these structural causes or structural lesions the cause of syncope? And so if you look at that question, it's probably on the order of 2 to 4% of patients. And it's probably less than 1% of patients who have a structural cause that's aortic stenosis, right? So a lot of these other structural causes are things like the pulmonary hypertension, the pericardial effusions, things like that. It's actually pretty rare to find new aortic stenosis on an echo in a patient who's admitted with syncope, probably on the order of 1% or less. And so when you look at these cohorts, including the ones that are in the paper we're talking about tonight, three of the studies found a yield of 0% for echo.
That feels low.
that's a little bit low. And then the other two studies found rates of 2% and 4%. But what we have to remember about these numbers is, again, we're talking about a slightly different cohort, right? So what they are talking about in this paper are the patients who have a normal exam, no cardiac history, particularly things like no coronary artery disease and no heart failure, and a normal EKG, right? So we're talking about the unselected syncope patient, what is you might otherwise deem a low-risk syncope patient. Mm-hmm. There, it's exceedingly unlikely that you're going to find a cause.
Let's keep going. So I derailed our thought process there. So he had
answered the question about how often is syncope identified as a cause using echocardiography. And the next question, which was touched on by Dr. Dressler, was as far as what's the cost to diagnose one structural abnormality given how we are currently utilizing echocardiography. I don't know if someone wants to more eloquently ask that question, though.
If it's an exceedingly low yield test and it's not a particularly cheap test, how much does it cost to actually find an etiology? So in the Journal of Hospital Medicine paper, they did a calculation, and this is based on a cost of an echo of around $1,000 to $2,000. Mm-hmm. They determined that it would cost between $60,000 and $132,000 to make one diagnosis using echocardiography. And that seems about right. I mean, I think the cost figures, I forget the website they actually used, but I checked it out and it was, again, it's not a recommended cost. I believe that these are numbers that are for what a patient might be charged for an echocardiography. Because I don't know that it actually costs $1,000 to $2,000 to perform the echo. These are more charge data. But either way, it's a big number.
Tony, I just wanted to add in that I don't think that in those studies that we found any patients who had severe aortic stenosis who people didn't think had some sort of valvular problem to begin with. That usually what people were finding was maybe a low EF that they didn't expect. But otherwise, they weren't finding the occult severe aortic stenosis that somehow everybody missed on exam.
Yeah. So in one of the studies, probably one of the ones that sort of lays it out a little bit more clearly, with the kind of diagnoses they found were things like, again, pericardial effusion, pulmonary hypertension, aortic stenosis. But actually, all those diagnoses were made in patients who were not low risk. Those were in patients who had an abnormal EKG, an abnormal physical exam, or some historical feature that suggested an echo made sense. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's really about risk stratifying the patient at the time of admission. This kind of makes sense, right? But it's often not done. We say, well, you know, echo is non-invasive. It's just a little ultrasound. Let's just get it on everybody. And the reality is it's not necessary. And there's I don't know of any data, and Lenny, I'm not sure if you do, about length of stay associated with echo. But even though it's a more easily obtained test now, there are probably patients who stay in the hospital an extra day awaiting an echo, or are admitted on a Saturday and stay till a Monday awaiting an echo. And so, again, Lenny, I'm not sure if you're aware of length of stay data, but I suspect there could be a difference based on those sorts of events.
So I am not aware of any data to that effect, but I wouldn't be surprised by that either. Certainly have had a lot of patients who have stayed to get that echo that you said, did they really need that?
Exactly.
But I also wonder what kind of downstream sort of unnecessary workup happens as a result too. Like if you get the echo because you're looking for, you know, rip-raging aortic stenosis or wildly depressed systolic function, and you end up finding like a little ditzel or a doodad or sort of like a mildly depressed systolic function or something that you don't quite know what to do with, and then you're sort of committed to working that up ad nauseum too.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a patient at Cashlec recently who was admitted. I don't think he was admitted with a diagnosis of syncope, but nonetheless, he got an echo and he had a borderline EF, no symptoms of heart failure at all. And we were like, what the heck do we do with this? And we were actually kind of flummoxed.
Incidental anomas are found everywhere, right?
Absolutely.
Stuart, did you want to mention anything about carotid massage? I think you had some info there.
Well, no, it was more of a question of as far as if a patient presents with a new onset syncope, let's just go through like briefly what your workup would look like.
So for a patient with syncope without these risk factors.
Exactly. You've got, yeah, you know, normal EKG. History exam is relatively unremarkable. What does your workup look like?
So for many of these patients, it ends there. You know, you're going to get this patient had a CBC, so they're not severely anemic. I'll say that the utility of telemetry in all admitted patients is probably not high. I can maybe count on one hand the number of times telemetry has revealed something, but I do put most of my patients on telemetry who are hospitalized with a diagnosis of syncope. But this patient you might observe for 24 hours, and they have a pretty good story for a neurocardiogenic or vasovagal syncope, and then you discharge them. So I'm not sure what the four of you guys do routinely, but certainly head CTs, carotid ultrasounds, tilt table tests. I've never ordered one of those. Matt asked Stuart about carotid sinus massage. I have not done that as a routine modality in these patients.
So I probably order probe BNPs more often than I need to on these patients. I feel like it's a cheap way of getting the same information that I'm often getting an echocardiogram for, and that's if I'm in any way worried that the patient might have a low EF. That's the one other thing I add. The European guidelines are really great. If you haven't looked at the European syncope guidelines, they were out new in the last about year to 2 years, and they have some symptoms on there that you can put into low risk versus high risk, and I think are very helpful in trying to put together, is this a low risk patient or not in your head. And one of those is passing out while you're eating.
There's actually there's also a Canadian risk or Canadian syncope risk score, which is useful as well to determine. You can kind of categorize high, low, moderate risk, and whether or not you need to admit them or not. But
yeah, you know, to Lenny's point about a BNP, I think there's a little bit of emerging data about the use of markers like BNP and troponin as a way to be more confident that a patient is low risk and does not need echocardiography. So the last year in the Journal of Hospital Medicine, there was a study published that looked at history of congestive heart failure, history of coronary disease, abnormal EKG, and then troponin BNP, those five things. So if you lacked those, the probability of an adverse event was exceedingly low.
I do think syncope is interesting because it's one of those diagnoses that if you are not comfortable with uncertainty, you're going to have issues with that diagnosis, because so often, as Tony alluded to, we don't actually find a diagnosis, and we need to be comfortable with saying we've ruled out the bad stuff, and it's okay if we don't know exactly why this happened.
I'm going to try to recap before we move on to the next topic. Someone comes in with syncope. We're doing a full history and exam, an EKG. We might do biomarkers, which would be troponins and a BNP, and then the echo. Unless the patient has an abnormal EKG or a significant cardiac history, you could probably skip the echo. Any major things I'm missing, Tony?
Sure. So has anyone heard the adage that as aortic stenosis gets more severe to, you know, critical, that a murmur can actually get quieter and go away? Anyone ever heard that?
I've heard that before.
Yes.
Yeah. So I had heard that repeatedly. I tried to find evidence to support that. And the reason, of course, is if you auscultate someone's heart and you don't hear a murmur, boy, wouldn't it be nice to say I've ruled out aortic stenosis. And the data that I was able to find, there's a great study from 1991 that you can put in the show notes. Basically, no patient with either moderate or severe aortic stenosis lacked a murmur, meaning they all had a murmur. And 70 of 74, or 95% of patients with mild had a murmur. So if any of your listeners knows of a study or even a case report of a patient with severe or critical AS who did not have a murmur, I would love to see it because I feel like that is handed down and it is such folklore.
Yeah. Unless their valve is no longer moving. It's
well, so I think the kind of patient in whom you might see it is someone who's got like an EF of 10, 15% and simply cannot generate flow across that valve. But that patient ain't presenting in a subtle way.
Right, right. So, yeah, I mean, obviously like the peak gets later is the thing that I'd heard. I'd not actually heard of the murmur just kind of vanishing that I have a harder time wrapping my head around.
Yeah, the absence of a second heart sound and the late peaking are probably some of the better predictors of severity.
Paul, would you mind reading our case, our next case for Lenny?
Happily. We're doing a docusate?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, you don't want to have a favorite child, but this one's great.
It's a gift to keep on giving.
An 80-year-old female, no significant past medical history. She presents with a mechanical fall. Her x-rays are notable for a right hip fracture. She is treated with morphine for analgesia and evaluated by orthopedic surgery for surgical repair. The hospitalist recognizes that this patient is at high risk for constipation and orders docusate for prevention of constipation.
Drops the mic and walks off.
So we solved the problem. So I guess we've all used it. We've all prescribed it. We all know what it is. I guess, Lenny, can you just at least start with a background of how docusate came to be one of the most wildly popular laxatives that we have, or I guess we can't even really call it a laxative, but sort of stool facilitator.
Yeah, so it's classified actually as a detergent or a surfactant or softening or wetting agent. It has a lot of different names. Basically, the idea is you give them the docusate and then they're going to absorb water more as the stool goes through the colon. And so that's supposed to soften up the stool, and then it must be easier to come out that way. So, you know, where this came from, why it became so popular, I don't know if I can give you that answer, because there's just so little data that showed that it worked that I'm not sure how it got out there. There's got to be some story of how this was marketed.
Big that, pharma.
Yeah, big, absolutely. But somehow it even got to the WHO, who said, you know, the World Health Organization, who says it's an essential medicine.
It's amazing.
it's good
for them.
Yeah, it's written on one of the JAMA patient pages that we should be taking it. It's everywhere.
Oh, wow.
And so it really prescribed a heck of a lot. There was a study out of McGill University in Montreal. Docusate, not surprisingly, the most frequently prescribed laxative. It is 64% of the laxative medication doses that they give there at McGill. A patient's averaged about 10 doses of docusate per admission across 17,000 admissions. And then 50% of those patients were discharged on docusate. They thought it cost them about $60,000 per year for the docusate that they were prescribing, about a quarter of that from the medication itself, and then all the other expenses of labor and administration. So it's used a heck of a lot. In Toronto, 15% of all hospitalized patients are prescribed at least one dose of docusate. I would say the same thing is true at my institution. I'm sure that is true at CashLAC. It's probably up at 25, 50% at CashLAC. And then one third in this Toronto study, one third of all new inpatient prescriptions were continued at discharge. So we are starting this medication, and we can go through the data about whether this works or not. But we are starting this medication in lots of patients, and then we are continuing it when we send them home. Either as a PRN or not.
We should put a say something just ridiculous, like DocuSate causes autism. Just walk off.
Can I, at my own institution, which I will not name so that I don't get beat, my own institution, it's 165,000 tablets a year. 165,000 tablets a year.
Of not the capsules?
Or capsules of 100 milligram. And that's about 450 a day of DocuSate.
So what are the harms of giving DocuSate? What's other than the cost? What are the harms?
And autism.
Soapy stools.
So we've got Stuart's bad science going on over there. I wish I could say it's something as bad as that. Although I think in some ways it could be, right? So you start this patient who actually is at risk for having constipation on DocuSate that is not going to help her. And you expect it to do something. And then you wait and you wait and she waits and she waits and she does not move her bowels. And finally, day three, day four, she's not feeling very well. And we say, actually, maybe we should give her a medication that really works. So we've given this medication that, granted, doesn't cost very much at our institution. I think it costs 3 cents per capsule. It's cheap, but it doesn't do anything for the patient. And then we've wasted time when we could have been giving the patient a medication that actually works, which I think is what we're supposed to be doing for for our patients who were worried about having constipation. People also say that it has a bad taste. It's another medication among the many medications that someone is taking. So if they are deciding that they're going to take their DocuSate over their Carvedilol, that's probably not a good idea. And then, of course, the nurse is giving this medication twice a day. And that's 450 pills at my institution. So they're giving whatever, 220 of them, 25 of them twice a day. That's time that they're going to the Pyxis, getting the medication, going to the patient. This is your DocuSate. This helps with your constipation. And then to get nothing out of it, that doesn't seem to be like a medication we want to be giving.
So the evidence for this medicine, you kind of teased it. I mean, the gist that I got from this article was that there were some very low quality studies in either the 50s or the 60s that said maybe it works, and then more recent, but they were very few patients. And then more recently, in the past like 20 years, there was one or two studies with more patients that were probably of better quality that really didn't find any benefit from giving DocuSate versus placebo or just kind of in addition to normal bowel regimen. Is that a fair statement, or is there more nuance to it than that?
Not really, but can I walk you through this? So
yes.
Right, we're giving 162,000 of these a year at my institution. Here are the number of patients who were in the studies.
Right.
And there's about 7 of them. You ready?
Yeah.
The first study, 15. The next study, 34. The next study, 46, 12, 15, 170, and 74. Right? Yeah. A medication.
Sound like cardiology studies.
Exactly. A medication that is given all the time, yet there is very small numbers. And that first study, that one in 1968 that had 15 mm-hmm. patients, that was supposed to be a randomized controlled trial, in the end, they ended up excluding 19 patients because of placebo effect.
So placebo is better.
They said it worked because they excluded 19 patients who were on placebo. And then it started getting out there like wildfire after that. So it's hard to explain.
No pun intended.
Exactly. I've been trying to figure out how I'm going to include the word crap load in all of this, but which is the amount of medication we give at our hospital. But it's just an incredibly few number of patients for a medication that has so infiltrated our system.
To give our audience some practical tips, that what should they be using, pharmacologic or non-pharmacologic therapy wise?
Yeah, that is a great question. So there's actually a few reviews in the last few years on the subject. a review in the American Journal of Gastroenterology from 2005. There was a review about constipation in opioid patients. There's a review from the American Society of Colon and Rectal Surgeons. So there's actually some good information out there. And the American Journal of Gastroenterology put grade A for medications like polyethylene glycol and grade B for psyllium and lactulose. So, of course, we know that polyethylene glycol and lactulose fit into that osmotic laxative category. And then the psyllium fits into the bulk or hydrophilic laxative category. And then we talked about the surfactant or softening or wetting, which is wetting agent, which is docusate. And then, of course, you have the peristolic stimulants, the Senna kind of medications that we think about. But so the ones that are studied the best, I think, are the ones that we see used really often by GI, particularly to clean out patients, because they actually clean out patients and they treat constipation. And those are those medications like polyethylene glycol. And then you have the newer kids on the block, which I think likely help as well, the medications for the opioid constipation. But for your run-of-the-mill constipation, I think the medications like polyethylene glycol and ones like that that are over-the-counter are great medications for this.
One of the articles that I was reading, I can't remember which one, was just making the point that the newer agents, they work, but they're more expensive, and they haven't necessarily been studied head to head with some of the older agents that we know that they work. So just kind of hanging that out there. So I think there's a lot of reason to use the older, like, tried and true agents before you get not DocuSafe, but the rest of them.
Right.
And there's a nice article from Mayo Clinic Proceedings from 2019, and they pretty much list, like, in addition to the ones that you mentioned, Lenny, like bisacodyl and Senna as stimulant laxatives are other kind of cheaper agents, cheaper options that you can use. Linaclotide costs like $466 per month, and the other agents in that class are around that, versus about less than $10 for all the other agents that we've mentioned so far per month.
And then you have to, and then, you know, we're talking about hospitalized patients, so you're probably not going to keep them on the Senna or stimulants for very long, but you need to think about how long you want to keep your patient on a stimulant type medication. I think in general, the osmotic laxatives are probably a safer chronic medication than those medications that are stimulant-based. And then there are all the other non-pharmacologic things that we didn't talk about. People will talk about dietary modifications and mobilization, which we know in the hospital is a pretty tough thing to do when everyone's on a bed alarm. But to get them up and walking around so that they actually move their bowels. The studies that have looked at what happens when you are left in bed for long periods of time show us that one of the things that happens is you don't go to the bathroom very often. You become constipated. So get them up, walk them around. People also recommend things like chewing gum and biofeedback. I don't know the data behind those things. But chewing gum, pretty cheap and reasonable thing to do as long as they're not going to aspirate.
I think it's just talking about the gastrocolic reflex. Maybe that's what they're thinking with the chewing gum, because one of the other things I read was that you give the stimulant laxatives 30 minutes after a meal to try to sync it up with the gastrocolic reflex, which I just loved. Like, I don't know if that's true or not, but it just sounds cool.
Well, I think there's some data on gum chewing in the postoperative setting to promote bowel movements and or passing of gas. I don't know that it's used in medical patients, but I think I've seen literature in surgical patients.
Oh, wow.
Fantastic.
Lenny, can I ask a question?
Sure.
So this strikes me as the sort of thing that, yes, there's harm in delay of appropriate therapy, but I wonder if this is something that requires a system-level change. And so are you aware of any hospitals that have taken it off formulary?
I'm trying right now. I'm in the midst of that at my own institution.
But then what are you going to use for earwax? I mean, come on.
So it was really interesting that the response I got from my institution, and hopefully we're going to get them to rethink this and we're working on that, was that this is not a first-line medication, but it has a different mechanism of action from the other medication, so we should keep it on the formulary. And my response was, maybe has a different mechanism of action, but then it doesn't work. So why would we keep it on the formulary? And clearly, we're not using it as a second-line medication. It's 165,000 capsules a year. No one is using it as a second-line medication. It just needs to be taken off.
You should recommend
that they replace
the chewing gum.
Just to be clear, your home institution is, and just to be clear, your home institution is Cashlack, because I don't want to have to, I don't want to have to bleep you again.
Yeah, my home institution of Cashlack. They are fighting me on this.
Just tell them that you'll replace it with chewing gum, which has a different mechanism of action as well.
and biofeedback.
All right, so our last patient of the day, we've got a 60-year-old male with obesity and type 2 diabetes mellitus presenting to the emergency department with influenza type A, complicated by pneumonia. Before admission, he had been managing his diabetes with metformin 1,000 milligrams twice a day, and on arrival, his blood sugar was a healthy 275 milligrams per deciliter. The admitting provider decided to hold the patient's metformin and replaced it with insulin on a sliding scale. So, couple of questions for you. Number one, can we define hyperglycemia in hospitalized patients so we know what we're dealing with here?
Yeah, so hyperglycemia in the hospital setting is typically greater than 140. And most guidelines recommend that we start an insulin therapy if the blood sugar is consistently over 180. But again, 140 is often the cutoff you'll see. So this patient clearly meets that criteria.
And so before we start dicing away at the orders that were placed by this poor provider, can you tell us what sliding scale insulin is?
Sure. So sliding scale insulin is short-acting insulin administered 3, usually 4 times a day, so before each meal and then close to bedtime. And it's administered in reaction to an elevated glucose. And the higher the glucose, the more insulin is administered. And, you know, we're recording this the second week of July. I suspect just about every new intern, if they've been on an inpatient rotation, has probably ordered some version of this. It's a very, very, very common inpatient order.
So they're doing the right thing, right?
and so a correction dose insulin, and there's a lot of uncertainty about the terminology, but what we're really talking about, if we're talking about this as a thing we do for no reason, is sliding scale insulin as monotherapy, right? So giving a short acting insulin before a meal, if you're also giving bolus, that is recommended by endocrinology and diabetes societies. What we're talking about tonight is monotherapy, short-acting or regular insulin monotherapy.
I guess the follow-up question is, why is this such a prevalent practice?
So I think to understand that, it actually helps to understand a little bit of the history as to how we got to where we are. This will be brief, but it actually does require us to go back to the 1920s. So in the early 1920s, Banting and Best discovered insulin, gave insulin, changed the world. And this was regular insulin, right? So what we talk about regular insulin, we're talking about the insulin that was discovered and used back in the 1920s. And it wasn't until the 70s or 80s that capillary blood glucose testing became available. And so what that meant, and I'll say doing like a serum blood glucose test was extremely labor intensive, right? So for about 50 years, from the 1920s up until the 70s or 80s, we had to use surrogate markers for glycemia. And what we used was the urine. Right, so if you remember the maximal concentration of glucose that can be delivered before you start spilling glucose is 180 milligrams per deciliter. So if a diabetic in the 1940s or 1950s noticed that there was urine glucose in their urine, that meant their blood sugar was over 180, and they would give some amount of insulin. And if you look back to some of the textbooks from the 30s and 40s, the sliding scales are fascinating because what they would recommend doing is mixing the urine with something called phthalein solution, which is just copper sulfate, and the urine would change color, right? So a classic sliding scale from Joslin was something like 5 units for green insulin, 10 units for yellow insulin, and 15 units for orange insulin.
Urine, right? You mean?
Urine.
Sorry, yeah, yeah. So 5 units for green, 5 units of insulin for green urine, 10 for yellow urine, and 15 units for orange urine. Yeah. And then in the 1980s, I think what happened was as capillary blood glucose testing became available, we're like, well, we've been using sliding scales for 50 years. We're just going to keep doing it. And when I was a resident, it was actually continued to be regular insulin sliding scale, but I think most people now use the more short-acting or quick-onset Lispro and Aspar sliding scales. So to answer your question, Stuart, I think it's largely a product of this kind of thing being grandfathered in, right? There are some things that we've been doing for years that really never met the test of evidence-based medicine, like bridging anticoagulation, right? We've just been doing it forever. And so now it's our job to prove that it's unnecessary before we get rid of it.
So what should we be doing instead?
So I think to answer that question, you kind of have to understand, is there any risk of sliding scale insulin? Because I'll tell you what, you know, there's a couple different ways to answer that too. And I'll tell you that my answer is going to be slightly different, or one recommendation is going to be slightly different than what some of the guidelines say. But to understand what we might do differently, we got to understand, well, what is sliding scale insulin actually getting us? It's probably not getting us a reduction in serum glucose. Because it's reactive, right? We're waiting for a glucose to be elevated, and then we're giving the medication. So there's no evidence to suggest it prevents hyperglycemia. And there's even some studies suggesting that patients who are on sliding scale monotherapy have more hyperglycemia compared to patients who aren't getting anything at all, which seems kind of counterintuitive. But this data that I'm alluding to is observational data from 1997. But nonetheless, it certainly doesn't seem as though we're reducing hyperglycemia. And so the question is there something that we can do that does reduce hyperglycemia? And the most commonly recommended therapy is basal bolus, right? So that's some long-acting insulin, something like a glargine, and then a short-acting insulin on top of that. And I think most of your listeners have probably done that at some point, but I also suspect that most of your listeners continue to do sliding scale insulin monotherapy in some of their patients. So I'm not sure if that answered your question, Stuart.
Are there any patients for whom monotherapy would be the solution?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is yes. And I think that the main patient in whom monotherapy makes some sense is the patient in whom you're particularly worried about hypoglycemia. Because unsurprisingly, the more insulin you give, right, the greater your risk of hypoglycemia. And not every study that compares sliding scale monotherapy to basal bolus shows increased risk of hypoglycemia with basal bolus, but some certainly do. And when you look at meta-analyses, and there have been a few meta-analyses published in the last few years, there certainly is a trend towards more hypoglycemia if you have a basal backbone. So, you know, if you've got someone who's brittle or who has shown a predisposition to hypoglycemia, that's the patient you want to be careful about.
So I want to ask a question about oral hypoglycemic specifically. So you had mentioned the threshold, the glomerular filtration threshold of 180 milligrams per deciliter of glucose. Now, one of the medications that we have today that actually addresses quite nicely and gives its own like sliding scale is SGLT2 inhibitors. Is there any data about utilizing that as an inpatient adjunct or in lieu of insulin therapy?
Yeah, so you definitely can't use the failing solution method of sliding scale if you're on an SGLT2 inhibitor, because you're probably right. Always going to be getting an orange urine and 15 units of insulin. So there are some non-insulin therapies that have been tested in the hospitalized setting. So exenatide, saxagliptin, sitagliptin, they've been tested. And I don't think they've been shown to be superior, but they've been shown to be similar to basal bolus. I think there are maybe some studies evaluating the continuation of SGLT2 inhibitors in the hospital setting. I'm unaware of any studies that have looked at initiating SGLT2 inhibitors as a means of glycemic control in the hospital. I'm not sure if any of the four of you have seen anything.
There are I'm aware of some that are in design phase right now, looking at specifically heart failure patients with diabetes as an adjunct or as an add-on to traditional diuretic therapy, and also for glycemic control during the inpatient setting. And this is based on outpatient data that looks at reduced hospitalization for heart failure patients and better volume control.
I think underlying the point Stuart's making about oral meds, there's been kind of whispers of this on Twitter, and I think there's been some stuff in the literature recently about, like, we're probably a little bit too conservative when it comes to using any oral medications for patients who are hospitalized. And the 2018 ADA guidelines from Diabetes Care mentioned that, like, once the patient's kind of stable and they're 1 to 2 days out from discharge, you should consider restarting their oral medications. Tony, do you have any comments on, like, the safety of this?
Yeah, so what I'm going to say now is a personal opinion, and it's somewhat consistent with my practice style, and it's also coming from someone who's married to an endocrinologist, but she's many rooms away, so she can't hear what I'm saying. So I think we hold metformin in the hospital setting way too often. If a patient doesn't already have acute kidney injury, I don't see any reason to hold metformin in the hospital, right? Once they have acute kidney injury, they then have to accumulate metformin, and then they have to then get lactic acidosis from that accumulation. So I think it's reasonable to hold it once you got acute kidney injury. In fact, I think you should. But because somebody has a risk factor for acute kidney injury, you're many steps upstream from lactic acidosis. So I'm not seeing the aggressive recommendation to hold it. And I'll tell you, if one of our goals is glycemic control, metformin probably reduces a fasting glucose on the order of 30 milligrams per deciliter and a postprandial on the order of 60 milligrams per deciliter, right? That's a few units of insulin that we're saving this person if we just continue a medication that is a good medication. So again, that's not the recommendation of the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists or the American Diabetes Association. I do hope that they begin to move the needle in the direction of a more liberal allowance of it in the hospital setting. I see Stuart nodding. I don't know if you're in agreement, Stuart.
No, you said move the needle.
Yeah, here's what you said about the pun. I saw this coming a mile away.
Wait, what's the pun with a needle?
Insulin.
Oh, the insulin needle?
Insulin. You're moving the needle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Tony, I don't think in puns either. Now it's like kind of creeping in because of Stuart, but before this, I did not think in puns.
Yeah, you got to needle them up a little bit. So can I add in a couple things? One, there was a recent study of patients, outpatients with on metformin that looked at patients' GFR and how they did with metformin in terms of lactic acidosis. And another confirmation that really the only patients who tend to get in trouble with lactic acidosis are patients who have a GFR of less than 30. You probably shouldn't initiate metformin if they're between 30 and 45. But if they're already on it and fall into the 30 to 45 category, you're probably okay. And then certainly above 45, even though we have tended not to use metformin, the study really seemed to indicate that patients do pretty darn well in terms of lactic acidosis. And I also wanted to add in, we just talked about SGLT2 inhibitors. The other meds that are coming that there are probably more data about already in the hospital are the DPP-4 inhibitors and the GLP-1 agonists. They actually have some relatively good data behind them that they're pretty safe in the hospital and that they help you to reduce the amount of insulin that you're giving patients. And in my book, I really don't like insulin as a drug. If we can reduce the amount of insulin we're giving anybody, we're probably doing a good thing overall. The DPP-4 inhibitors, you have to worry about heart failure. You probably don't want to give it in the patient who you're treating for a heart failure exacerbation in the hospital. And the GLP-1s, you have to worry a little bit about the GI side effects if you were starting that and whether they're going to start vomiting on you in the middle of the hospital and what that means. So there are drugs that are probably coming to the hospital near you, the inpatient center near you, as medications that you will be using and not just the insulin in the hospital. And then, go ahead, Stuart.
I was going to say, I have found it so odd that we take these patients, hospitalize them, and say, you know, that those medications you take as an outpatient, they are so dangerous, We're going to stop them.
Right.
Oh, and by the way, we're discharging you today. Those dangerous medications, please resume them once you get home. It's so odd to me.
Yeah.
Well, that all feeds into the notion of contrast-induced nephropathy and whether that's a real thing or is that a thing we believe for no reason. So we can get to that on a future episode. And can I just add one more thing? For those of you who do get nervous about hypoglycemia, if you're doing the basal bolus nutritional, there is reasonable data of doing just basal plus correctional and leaving out the nutritional because maybe you're not sure how much your patient is going to eat. Maybe your nurses aren't very good at adjusting the dose if the patient's not eating very much or forgoing the nutritional dose if they don't eat. So there is reasonable data, particularly in both medical and surgical patients. The same folks who did the Rabbit 2 study that got us to the doing the basal or basal plus nutritional that showed that basal plus correctional is a reasonable regimen.
Yeah, the article from JHM advocated a basal plus sliding scale insulin or correctional insulin, whatever we're going to call it. And then if patients had like a more steady diet then and they needed it, you could add in a sort of prandial insulin in addition to the correctional and the basal insulin. Tony, what do you do for the weight-based dosing? Like when you are, if you are going to start them on a basal regimen?
So I frankly, just usually start people on 10. I just give them 10. You know, 10 plus a correction dose. And then if I'm confident that you're eating, you'll get some prandial as well. And let's get you back on your home medications as soon as we're, all confident that, you know, it's safe, whatever that means. But I, frankly, the weight-based is the recommended way of doing it. But for simplicity's sake, I just go with 10 of Lantus.
I like it.
I'm a weight-based guy. So I go with generally arrange for the total daily dose of 0.3 to 0.5, depending on how insulin resistant I think the patient is and what their renal function is and what their age is. So certainly if their creatinine's getting up there, I'm going much closer to 0.3. If I think this is someone who is really insulin resistant, I'm starting at 0.5. And then I am taking half of that in general as the basal dose and leaving the other for either nutritional or just leaving it off the table and just doing the basal plus correctional.
So for our typical 100 kilogram patient in the United States, you'd be giving them anywhere from 30 to 50 units total, and they'd be getting anywhere from 15 to 25 units of basal insulin.
Absolutely.
I like.
And the studies are have borne out that that's a very reasonable regimen.
Yeah, and I think that is very reasonable. I have a tendency to err on the side of trying to avoid hypoglycemia at all costs. So, you know, if the kind of patient Lenny's describing, I think absolutely if you're very concerned or there's evidence that the patient's going to be insulin resistant, they're going to need more insulin, undoubtedly. But they're probably on insulin as an outpatient then, mm-hmm. or you'd hope they would be.
Dr. Williams, please.
No, I'm scared to say what I do because I have endocrinology friends that listen to the show. So I'm going to say weight-based for life. I'm a big fan of the weight-based. That's what we should be doing all the time, and I would never ever just start 10 units because it's a round number, and that's what I do every single time, if I'm being honest.
I just told my wife they were talking about hypertensive urgency again, so she can't somehow critique what I'm saying.
Tony, Lenny, this was awesome. I really, this felt like a lot of fun. I learned a lot by kind of researching, reviewing for it. Yeah, this whole series is awesome. You know, I was definitely guilty of lots of the things that were in this just because I had been taught the wrong thing. So I'm so glad that you guys are doing this.
I just want to add, they're not to butter your bread, but just so beautifully written too. Like they're just actually a genuine pleasure to read in addition to being incredibly useful and practical. They're beautifully done.
Yeah. I mean, Lenny deserves so much credit because they're not these, 5,000 word systematic reviews. They're succinct things that you could hand to a resident in rounds and be like, look, it's only 1500 words. You know, you can read it, in the next, over lunch, and actually learn something. They're really nicely succinct.
Yeah.
And Let me mention that the Society of Hospital Medicine Education Committee is working on creating some slide decks for every one of the articles that we've done so far so that you could use them as a teaching tool in the hospital or in the clinic, wherever you think that it is applicable. And then the other thing is things we do for no reason, trademark pending.
Okay.
Congratulations.
He already has a tattoo.
Now just wait for that sweet journal money to start rolling in. So,
everybody wants it.
All right, gentlemen, any final asks or plugs that you'd like to leave the audience with?
I would just plug we've had such great authors who have written these things we do for no reason. We're over 40 of them already. Obviously, Tony and I put in a significant amount of time editing them, but nothing happens without the authors who put them all together in the first place. We're always looking for new authors. Justin Burke may be one of those authors in the near future. I know he has an article that's being reviewed right now, so we'll see what comes of that. But if you are interested, may I plug my email that you can email me?
Sure.
Yeah, it is fine. LF@jhmi.edu. We also have a things we do for no reason email, but that's not quite as easy to remember as LF@jhmi.edu. So if you want to write one of these and you have an idea, don't email us saying we can figure out an idea together. No. Email us with an idea that you have of a thing we do for no reason. And then Tony and I will get back to you as to whether we should keep moving forward with it.
And sort of on along the same lines in terms of a plug, we really like to hear from trainees. I think the four of us are so far gone, we don't even recognize the things that we do for no reason anymore. We're just like, hey, this is the way medicine is. I started to think about this when I was a resident, and this all derived from the realization that I was doing these things, like ordering folates on every patient with anemia, and I didn't understand why I was doing it. And I think it's the new interns who are now starting to do these things and the junior residents who I really hope I start to identify some of these things, start asking questions, and then email me and Lenny with proposals because we'd love to help them publish.
And can I also mention I have recorded this entire show in my new cowboy boots.
Excellent.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/podcast and sign up for our mailing list at thecurbsiders.com/knowledge food to get our weekly show notes in your inbox.
That's right, Paul, because we are committed to providing you with high-value practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes or contact us at... Or contact us at thecurbsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to our producer. Man, I can't do it. Special thanks to our producers for this episode, Justin et al. Speaking of which, we just learned that Justin is recently unemployed. So if you have a spot on your team, please let him know. And to our social media team, Hannah R. Abrams on Twitter, Beth Garbs Garbatelli on Instagram, and Chris the Chew Man Chew on Facebook. Until next time, I've been Stuart Kent Brigham.
Justin is not unemployed. Justin is very gainfully employed in a very short period here. He's just in... He's on hiatus. Yeah, come on.
Would you like me to re-record that?
No, it's... Yeah.
Got it.
Justin will be... Can I say Justin? Justin will be starting his first new job out of training very shortly. He is not unemployed.
They grow up so fast.
They do. So until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto. Burke?
He's the Burke Man Burke.
I've been Dr. Justin Lee Burke.
Flawless. And I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.
Good night, Paul. Good night.
I've actually, in my own experience, found that bilateral carotid massage 100% of the time since the movie. A patient just go right out. It's pretty remarkable. I would.
Is that a recommendation?
Evidence-based.
100%.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.